This is the Mentoring Developers Podcast, episode 60. Let's get started.
Welcome to Mentoring Developers, the podcast for new and aspiring software developers, where we discuss your struggles, anxieties, and career choices. And now, here's your host, Arsalan Ahmed.
In this episode of Mentoring Developers, we'll be talking to Alan Kelly. Alan is a highly respected book author, agile coach. He is a presenter, he mentors, and he trains big corporations and teams of software developers how to be good software developers, how to actually achieve the goals, and how not to suck. He comes to us with a wealth of experience, knowledge, and a really fresh perspective on building software, being successful with software that I think both software engineers and people who want to be software engineers will benefit from, and also managers, product managers, hiring managers, people who are CEOs, CTOs, and running companies, and they're making big decisions, think they're going to benefit from this episode as well. I'm really excited to get the chance to talk to Alan and bring his point of view, and we're going to discuss a lot of what goes on in software development and how we can make it better. If you are involved in software development in any way, you will really like this episode. All right, here it is, my discussion with Alan Kelly. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Mentoring Developers. Today, my guest is Alan Kelly. And Alan, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for asking, Arsalan.
So happy to have you here. You are not in the US. You're based in London. Is that right?
Yeah. I'm sitting here in sunny London.
Sunny London.
No rain today.
That is incredible. And I am so sorry that I have to hold you in your office, your home office right now, instead of being out there and having fun in those rare sunny days in London. So the question is, who is Alan? And you told me that you are an agile coach and you coach people and teams about how to do better, and you mentor people, and you have so much that you have done in your life. And we really want to go into that. But there is one story about your first proper programming job that you got, and that was 5 years after you graduated, and it was supposed to be this amazing new opportunity where you do things, and it didn't go according to plan. What happened?
So you know, I'd already been earning money out of programming before college, and I went to college, and I learned how to do it properly. You know that thing where you ask users what they want, and you write it all down, and you design it, and then you build it, and everything's cool, and you learn all that in college. And then I graduated, and I get to the real world, and like nobody does it like that. It's all over the place. And I do these jobs because you have to earn money, but I spent 5 years feeling guilty, doing project after project, thinking, you know, we don't do it the way we're supposed to. It's all wrong because we don't do it how I was taught in college. And then I get to work on this job for the British Railway System, and they're doing it properly. Everything is written down, and they've got an ISO approval and all the rest of it. And wow, I'm so happy to get this job. And it's a nightmare. It's an absolute nightmare. The documentation is as high as a five-year-old kid, you know. I spend half my week writing documents, and we get audited, and we're coached in how to answer the auditor's questions. And we've got these architects who, these architects came from a COBOL background. We're writing in C++. They have no idea what the technology we're using, but we got architects. So the code and the official architecture are like two completely different things. And then, you know, one lunchtime, this is like in central London, and one lunchtime I wander into a bookshop that is close to the office, and I find this book by a guy called Jim McCarthy. He's still around. He's brilliant if you get to see him. Dynamics of Software Development. And he just like opens my eyes, and suddenly I realize that, oh my God, you know, the way we were taught in school, the way I've been feeling guilty, that's the bit that's wrong. It never works out like that. And it can't work out like that. And Jim lays out how his team at Microsoft do things differently. And it's like, oh my God, I am not alone. I'm not the odd one out. And that was in the late 90s. And that was like the start of my journey to the thing that we now call Agile. So yeah, I got to do it properly with all those requirements documents, and it just didn't work.
Yeah, so it's interesting. If I have a lot of listeners who are just starting out who may not know about all these processes that we're talking about, so there, this idea that exists in academia in a lot of circles, and I've been part of them, where you talk about what's the best way to reliably build software that will be maintainable and the process that you follow is repeatable and that you can come out with software of high quality, just like you can do it with another piece of engineering. You can say, well, do this and you will result in a very high quality piece of software, which will have fewer bugs, fewer defects. It will work as expected and everything will be great. Right?
Yeah.
And then we have this idealized notion of how to build software, and we go into the real world and we see that it has flaws. Tell me a little bit about what issues you faced.
Oh, what issue I faced in that project? I remember we're doing software about trains and how trains move around the network. And one day one of the problems we had was we had a source code control system, but when you check something in, there's a load of paperwork. So you fill in these forms before you could check stuff in, and you had to get a line manager to check in your code. So like slowed everything down. And then once your code was checked in, the form goes to the testing department who build your code and they test it. And so one day we do this and they get this and it gets sent back to me with a bug report. And he says, it's doing this and it shouldn't do that. And I'm like, are you sure? And I go over and I talk to them, big guys. I go and talk to the testers. And we realize that what it says in the requirements document that the train should do and what the trains actually do in real life are like two different things. There's this one station, which when the trains go in, they come out in an odd way. And according to the manual, it never happens. According to the requirements, it doesn't happen. And someone said, we know trains do this. So I'm then told I have to go and speak to one of the customers people, but I'm also told I must not let on. I must find out what the train's doing in real life, but I must not let on that the document says one thing and we think it does something else. Because if that's the case, that's like a contract issue and they've got to like escalate it. So this is a project where we're working 6 days a week. On the seventh day, you carry a pager, back in the pager days, in case, because the testers are working 7 days a week. So we're trying to do as much as we can, as fast as we can. And yet we've got all these paper forms flying around. We've got all these conversations that don't exist. You aren't allowed to talk honestly to your customers. You know, there's like all these artificial barriers because we're doing it properly. And it's utterly crazy. You know, the way you can write something down and the way things happen in real life will never meet. And the more you write down, the more complicated it gets. And the more you write down, the less that people remember if they do read it. Yeah, it's those kind of things.
Yeah, these things happen because as we discover that people don't just turn up one day and they are enlightened software developers. They have a history, they have some baggage. In your case, there were some programmers that were perhaps coached in and trained in a different programming paradigm completely. And they're experienced, but they're not necessarily well-versed in this methodology for programming languages and all that. But also, people have their quirks, and it's not an exact science, unfortunately. Software development is not a science. I believe that it's a little bit of a ninja kung fu stuff.
Yeah, it's a bit of everything, isn't it? You know, I believe software development is engineering. I also believe engineering requires a bit of inventiveness, a bit of art. You know, I know people argue about whether it's engineering or not. They say, we're not good enough to be engineers. We haven't quite mastered it. And the thing is, most people who talk about software engineering and whether it's engineering or not, they don't know much about engineering. There's lots of different types of engineering. I I'm a third generation engineer. My father was an engineer. My grandfather's an engineer. They really had oil under the fingernails. They were ships engineers. At times they built ships. They spent most of their lives making ships work. You know, as a kid, you know, 7 or 8, I'd be going down ships engine rooms. I saw ships engines overhauled. And that informs me. I know that when you're engineering things, that's how the engine should work. And it doesn't always work like that. There's a bit of dirty oil got in there. Or, you know, the ship has got to sail and the guys haven't finished the maintenance. The ship's got to sail. There's a commercial imperative there. It's not, I think the idea that many people have about engineering and why they think software isn't engineering is because they aren't particularly well informed about actual engineering. And engineering is the art of the possible. Engineering is making things work within constraints. And absolutely, that's what we do in software. And yes, it requires some innovation. Yes, it requires some imagination, blue sky thinking, call it what you will. There's a lot of different things in there. And I think that's all part of the engineering mix.
Right. So it's not clearly defined, and it's somewhere in the middle. But let's talk about you, Alan.
Yeah.
We want to understand who you are, where you're coming from. Tell us a little bit about it. So if I ever met you in a party and say, hey, tell me a little bit about yourself. Let our listeners understand who you are.
Who I am? Well, I'm Alan Kelly. I live here in London. You know, I used to be a programmer. I used to put my fingers on the keyboard and I used to write code. And I still think of myself as that kind of person, although, you know, no one's paid me to code for many years. I still have my pet projects at home. But when I work with teams, when I work with developers, I see in them many of the frustrations I had as a programmer. I got to a point a few years after I turned 30, I realized that I could make the code fly. I could make the code do what I wanted it to do. The code wasn't the challenge for me anymore. The challenge was the way we are asked to do stuff, the way we are set up as teams. You know, because once upon a time, a guy in his bedroom could write a program and he could make a lot of money. Yeah. And as a teenager, I was that guy. I didn't make a lot of money. I made a little bit of money. You know, I never had a Saturday job. I never delivered papers or worked in a shop. I used to write programs in my bedroom and I used to sell them as a teenager, you know, to magazines and the BBC and people. And that was how I kind of had money when I was a kid. So the code is still a problem for a lot of people, but what makes it so much more difficult is the way they are expected to perform, the structures they are put in, the way they are managed, the way their teams are sorted out, the way the needs, the requirements reach them. And so I when I work with teams and managers, I see the problems they're having and I say, yeah, I know that problem. I have lived that life. I want to help you with that problem. But in order to fix that problem with the code, we've got to rethink how you're going about structuring the code, because it's the structures, the organization, the culture, the whatever you like around it, which, you know, when you're sitting there to code, what are you thinking about? You can you think clearly about your code, or are you worried about something else? It's all that environment you're in. So I still think of myself as a software engineer, but I don't like the code look directly. I influence how the code is written by helping teams and organizations do a better job. So that's kind of what I'd say if I'd had a few drinks and we're at a party.
So what was your first encounter with programming? How did you even know that's a thing to do?
Right. So I was growing up in Liverpool in the 80s. And, you know, for those your listeners who are old enough to remember the 80s, and it's when home computers were just coming in. And one of our neighbors bought a Tandy TRS-80 Radio Shack machine. And, yeah, I'd go around that. I'd watch him and his dad typing in programs. You know, and I want some of that. So I persuaded my mum and dad to buy me a machine, a ZX81, we called them here. It's a Z80 machine with 1K of RAM. which after a few months, we got a pack made at 16K, not megabytes, K.
That's kilobytes, people.
Kilobytes, yeah.
and people are wondering, what's a kilobyte? I haven't heard that in a long time.
That's like a thousandth of a megabyte, you know, and that is 1,000th of a gigabyte. So I get this machine, you know, and it's just like, you know, I had found my thing, you know, and I was just hitting my teenage years. You know, and I was, me and the machine used to commune. You know, I gradually moved up from a 1K, 16K machine. I got this 32K machine with a 6502 processor. And that was where most of my money, you know, but I taught myself BASIC. I earned a little bit of money and I bought a book on machine code. So I used to write 6502 assembler and get things through stuff. And I got a bit more money. I could afford a Pascal compiler. I get Pascal. And, whoa, you know, as a self-taught programmer, I've got like go-tos all over the place and no go-to in Pascal. So I kind of relearned to program in a proper fashion, you know, the way you're supposed to. You know, and that's like still stuck with me. And I'll tell you a funny story. When I was 16, like most 16-year-olds here in England, you do your first proper school exams, you know, where they get marked and they get recorded forevermore. And I was one of those kids who did computer studies, as it was then. And we had to do a programming project as part of our assignment. And one of my teachers had an in with the examiners. He was one of the examiners. And he told me a year or two later that I scored 98% in the programming assessment.
Wow.
And do you know what I lost 2% for? I didn't use GoTo.
What?
The exam board had this list of things you had to demonstrate that you could program. And one of the things you had to demonstrate was to use the GoTo statement.
Wow.
So I'd already learned. So if I'd known that, I could have put a go-to in there somewhere, you know.
That's a problem with computer science education, because the teachers themselves, they, first of all, they're not equipped and they're not trained. But secondly, we follow, you know, these checklists of things. And this happens now too, where you have to do this because that's in the curriculum, even though the world has realized that this is actually bad practice, so we should avoid it.
Yeah, so, you know, this is a really key point, because for me, that was kind of like my one of those first big moments where you realize those experts aren't necessarily right, you know. And, you know, the story I told you before about being on a project where we're doing it properly, and properly was hell. And what's happening is that our education system, the people who come out of our education system, they have certain models. But because our technology is racing ahead, our technology is already invalidating some of those models people have. So, you know, you go back to the traditional model of how we develop software. You know, we call it the waterfall. You know, get out the requirements and do the analysis and do the design, blah, blah, blah. That makes perfect sense if it's 1970. That model comes from 1970, and we spent the 70s and the 80s perfecting the model, right? Let me remind you, well, even I don't remember this, but I've read up on this. Most of your readers can read up on this as well. In 1970, we had teletypes to communicate with our computers. If you had a screen, it was a green screen, and it showed you ASCII. We programmed our computers in COBOL on an IBM 360 OS mainframe. The IBM state-of-the-art mainframe had 4 gigabytes of RAM, 10 MIPS of processing power. My 8-year-old's got a Raspberry Pi. It's got 4,500 MIPS of processing power and 1 gigabyte of RAM, right? It's 2017. That traditional software process we've been taught about, it makes sense if you're programming IBM mainframes in 1970. In 1970, CPU cycles were really expensive. Paper and desk time was cheap. 2017, when you're programming your Linux or your Android, in Ruby or Clojure or, you know, one of these other modern languages. And CPU cycles are so amazingly cheap. That machine in your pocket has just burnt more cycles than Neil Armstrong had going to the moon. Now, CPU cycles are so cheap. Paper and desk time is expensive. It's far cheaper. And we can try out our ideas and get a quicker feedback loop. Yeah. But many of the things we're still being taught stem from an earlier age, and we're racing ahead. Trick is to spot what are those earlier lessons do we keep and which ones do we move on?
Okay. That's very, very wise, because we are always going to constantly be learning and evaluating our successes and failures. And then over time, the software industry tends to get better, right? We tend to understand how this works better. Uh-huh. But I think you will agree that context is also very important. What works in a sort of a very rigid scientific type environment, mm-hmm. or maybe an environment where the requirements don't change, and then your requirements for software development or your methodology may be completely different from something that is, you don't understand the problem itself and you're iterating. So we have talked about Agile and you've referred to it a few times and you're saying, well, we didn't have this term Agile before. And then you also don't necessarily like this term because it doesn't encompass everything. So tell us a little bit about what you mean by all this.
So best way to sum it up is, you know, I say, you know, the only thing you can really do wrong if you claim to be agile is to do things the same as you did 3 months ago. You should constantly be experimenting and innovating and trying new stuff. And some of it's going to work and some of it's going to fail. Now, I say that in an agile context, but that applies really to all software development because software is always changing. By definition, when we create software, we're creating something new. We're creating something innovative. If it already exists, you're going to reuse it. You're going to take it. You're going to download it from SourceForge or somewhere. If you've got some code that already does it, you ain't going to write it again. You're going to do Control-C, Control-V. You know, you're going to copy it. So when we're writing code, we're always doing something new. So we're always innovative. So really, all software development is about learning. We are learning about our tools, you know, our languages, our operating systems. That's perhaps the most obvious one. We're also learning about the problems we are solving, you know, whether you're creating medical equipment or train software or iPhones, you're learning about the problem you are trying to solve because we don't really understand the problems we're trying to solve. We think we do. But the truth is, as we start to create a solution, we view the problem, the thing we're creating, in a different way. You know, next time you're having trouble getting email on your phone, that's a new problem. How many people 10 years ago, 15 years ago knew they needed email on a phone? How many people 10 years ago knew they needed to send a 140-character message to the world? You know, We're constantly doing new stuff. And as we develop this new stuff, as we think of new ways of approaching it, we redefine the problems we're creating, the problems we're addressing, and we create new problems for us to solve later on. So the second way we're learning is about the thing we're creating. The third way we're learning is about the processes and the actions and how we're going to go about doing this. And there's some degree we're learning about learning there. So for me, all of our technology, all of our software is a multi-layered learning process, and we're constantly layering. Now, I think the traditional model, you know, the thing we call waterfall, it tried to freeze learning. It tried to say, look, we have learned all about the problem. We have written it down. We've now studied the architecture, and we've written it all down. We'll now give it to a simple programmer who will code something up, and when he's done that, we'll pass the test. And we tried to put it in boxes and freeze it. But what we see is that those boxes feed back to one another. And over time, as we've got faster, remember Moore's law, we're doubling processor power every 2 years. Our cycles are getting faster and faster. And our chain cycles are getting faster and faster. And so those boxes are interfering with each other faster and faster. And for me, the big thing about Agile is Agile says, hey guys, let's have a model which incorporates learning. Let's have a model that says we do something, we see what happens, we think about it, we reflect on it, maybe we change something, and then we do some more. And instead of doing these big episodes of learning and we try and compartmentalize them, Agile says, look, we'll do a little bit of learning. We will, when we try and compartmentalize it at the end of our sprint or iteration, we will try and compartmentalize it as something that actually works. And then when we incorporate the learning into the next thing we do, and we'll constantly build this Lego fashion, build this thing up. Each time we stop and we reflect and we consciously learn, we will have something to show for it. So if nothing else, what Agile gives us is a different model of how we develop software. And it's a model that more accurately reflects what we actually do, that we are learning a bit, doing a bit, learning a bit, doing a bit. We're learning as we do. Now, Agile has been so amazingly successful in the last 15 years that it's just become this massive umbrella. At the core, there's a few really core ideas, and for me, the core idea is learning. But now Agile encompasses so much. If you know, Arsenal, if you had a really great idea today about how people could improve their way to work software, or you thought of some really cool tool to help people, you call it Agile. You find some way of saying this too is Agile, because Agile is this massive umbrella brand name which everything gets lumped under. Nobody doesn't want to be Agile anymore. In doing so, it's become a little bit diluted. And the other thing is, and perhaps this is part of the reason why I shy away from the term, you know, I jokingly say, when I'm selling my services, when I'm marketing Alan Kelly Inc., I'm all about Agile and I talk about Agile. The moment I get a foot in the door, the moment I'm working with the team, I run as far away from Agile as I can. Everybody has heard about Agile these days. And everybody remembers something. And they probably remember the bit they don't like. Yeah, you know, it's the bit about the stand-up meeting. It's the bit about the pair programming. It's the, you know, it's there's something in there, and that will stick in their mind more. And so really, for me, Agile's about learning, and it's about doing better tomorrow than what you did yesterday. And everything else in Agile is just tools. And sometimes those tools are the right tools to use, and sometimes those tools are the wrong tools, and sometimes those tools can be abused. And let me give you an example here. What I'm picking up a lot of at the moment, and I'm picking this up more from my contacts in the US, but I'm hearing some of it in Europe as well, is that Agile is being used as a micromanagement tool. Because if you think about many of the tools in Agile, which are intended to be used to help teams self-organize, and intended to help individuals do a better job, like stand-up meetings, like planning meetings, like writing small pieces of work, like regular check-ins. They're really good for getting teams to work together, and they're really good for getting individuals to do good stuff. But exactly the same tools can be used by somebody for micromanagement purposes. Show me every check-in. What are you? Why weren't you at the stand-up meeting? You know, they're the same tools. They can be used for ill intent. They weren't intended for that. And I'm picking up a lot of vibes at the moment that I think some of these tools are being misinterpreted by people who don't share the mindset of it's learning. You know, there's people who want to control things, and control dampens learning, because control says one person, i.e. the controller, the guy who's trying to control all of this, is the learner, is the expert, and everyone else is just doers. And what we're saying is, no, everybody's a learner. Everybody's learning. Everybody's improving. And you know what? We learn better together. We learn better as a team when you can talk to people. Yeah.
I think that's something that's I have seen in my experience as well. And a lot of managers, they really like not only to control the events and how things happen, but they also want to control people. They want to control their time. They want to make sure. It's like the old boss in that movie, Office Space. There he goes. He wants to check in on people. Okay, make sure that you show up on this Saturday. Or are you still working on this? Or are you? yeah. I want to make sure that this is like the. I get this image of this 60s factory where there is a floor manager and he has all these workers that he is supervising, and he wants to make sure that everybody is outputting at 100% capacity.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That
yeah,
happens a yeah. lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And the it gets worse than that, because the guy who's trying to control this stuff, he is the guy who's had some success in the past. But because he's had some success with some things in the past, doesn't mean he knows really about managing people, controlling people. And some of those things he's had success with in the past, because as we were saying before, the technology's moved on. Some of those things were successful in the past. They don't work too well today. You know, so Gantt chart is a brilliant example of this. You know, the things Microsoft Project spits out. You know, 30 years ago, maybe they worked really well. Nowadays, project managers spend half their life updating them. But this guy who's had success with them in the past is now elevated to a position. And because he had success with them in the past, he tries to use them to manage everything. And the world's moved on.
And the world's moved on, and the world's constantly evolving. And maybe Gantt chart would be a useful tool in certain circumstances, even today, possibly. I can imagine if you do the same thing. Let's say that you're building a piece of software, which you argued that you don't need to build it if it's already been built. And that's true. But let's imagine a scenario where somehow we need to, let's say we're building tax software and tax, the way taxes go, and it's very regulated. And the only things change is maybe some of the rules, some of the finer points, but the structure stays the same. And forever, for whatever reason, the government decided that if you're going to build tax software, you have to start from scratch. In that case, you have done it 10 times already. So you know how the flow goes. You know what dependencies different components have. So you could say, I'm going to create... Let's talk a little... Can you tell us a little bit about Gantt charts? Because a lot of people are listening and they're what's a Gantt chart?
Thanks for that, Arslan. Because, you know, it's so easy for those of us who've been in this field for a while to throw out these terms. And we forget that, you know, there are a lot of people there. So a Gantt chart was invented by Mr. Gantt. That's where the name comes from. Doesn't stand for anything. And what he did was he wrote down all the things he thought he saw that had to be done. And he then said, right, well, so for all these things, there's a list of them. How long do we think they're going to take? And then he said, what's the best order of doing them in? And a Gantt chart is a mechanism for trying to arrange the tasks against time. You know, so if we're baking some bread, you know, first of all, get the ingredients, get the flour, get the water, get the sugar, you know, that has to be done before anything else. Second task, mix the flour, you know, mix the flour and the yeast and the water and everything else. Third task, let it rise. You know, and there's an order to these things. And if you're making bread, you know, you can schedule them. You know, in fact, I've got a bread machine. It all happens in a fantastic device. It all happens in the machine. We understand it so well. A machine can do this. So the Gantt chart is a mechanism. In some ways, it's a bit like managerial programming. It's about setting out all the steps and how long the steps are going to take to happen. Now the problem is that that's okay on paper, but when it comes to real life, things aren't as predictable as making bread even, you know, and those estimates are just estimates and things take longer and things don't. And some people try and solve this by making their Gantt charts more detailed. Well, that actually makes it worse because there's more things that can go wrong. Some people try and solve this by leaving what's called contingency in the Gantt chart. And you see this big contingency. This makes things worse because, people use contingency. You know, Arslan, listeners, think about this. When you were at college, do you remember you got those assessed piece of work, project work, term working? And at the start of the semester, your tutor would give you a piece of work and say, in 10 weeks' time, I want this handed in. Do you remember this? So when did you do the work?
In the last moment.
At the last possible, and I bet you 99 out of 100 of your listeners are the same. Once in a while, you meet somebody who did it early, right? These people exist, but overwhelmingly, people do it at the last minute. And, you know, and if as you get towards the end of that deadline, your tutor says, I'm going to give you an extra 2 weeks, people use the 2 weeks. Human beings, two things people really need to understand. Human beings are really bad at estimating how long something will take to do. This is provable in a laboratory. Get psychologists, they can prove this. Secondly, and the psychologist can prove this as well, human beings are really good at working to deadlines. Deadlines are a powerful force in our lives. So the problem with the Gantt chart is you lay all these things out and people, okay, I've got loads of time to do this. The deadline's not, we add all the numbers up and there's a deadline. But we don't follow the Gantt chart and things change. And if you leave contingency in there, it people use the contingency. Now, in defense of the Gantt chart, let's flip this around. They can be useful analysis tools. They can be a useful way of thinking through the work. They can be a useful way of analyzing it. Personally, I prefer a similar tool called the critical path analysis tool. But you pay your money, you take your choice. Those tools allow you to think about the work. The problem really comes is when people use that analysis tool as a means of trying to enforce the work, you know, trying to say, well, on the chart, you should be here and you're there. So I think some of these planning tools, they're very useful as planning tools, but planning is itself learning. Once you've finished doing your planning, once you've finished doing your learning, then get on and do it and throw those things away. You know, as President Eisenhower said, you know, plans are useful. Planning is essential. The process of planning is learning. It allows us to rehearse what we're doing. But the plans aren't a lot of use. A little bit of planning, a little bit of learning, very useful, benefit, very, very good. But remember, too much planning has negative returns. After a while, you're still planning. You aren't learning anything new. A bit further down, you're actually unlearning some of the stuff you think you've learned and you're overcomplicating. Just go and do it.
That's really profound. So do your planning. Do your Gantt charts if you have to do. Do any kind of other planning tools that you have. Use them and create a plan in your head. Create a plan on paper. Create a plan on a piece of software. And then once you understand what you're trying to do, then throw it away because you're not going to follow that and it'll always fall behind. It's the same way where we had, you know, back in the day, we had these giant, really thick book length software project requirements, right? Detailed project requirements. And then you're supposed to follow this, a 2-year project, and you're supposed to do these very fine grained requirements. Right to the T, and what happens is that the requirements keep changing because as we develop the features and we try to talk to the customers more, we realize we understood wrong and our assumptions were incorrect. So we try to compensate. And then there's one guy's job is to just keep updating the documentation.
Oh, God, yeah.
That doesn't go very well.
No. And, you know, the other thing about those documents is they always cry out to me, you kind of stop the world. We've written the document. Stop the world. Don't let anything else change. Just let us do what we said we were going to do. You know, I hate to break it to you, but the world keeps on moving, you know, and the world is more predictable as you look into the future. You know, next week, I think we know what we're doing next week, don't we? We know what we're doing in 2 weeks, a month, next month, this time next month, what we're going to be doing. This time in 3 months, what are we doing? You know, here in the UK, we don't even know what government we're going to have in 3 months. We've got an election in the middle. And if, you know, the stories I hear about the US, this impeachment world word, you know, could that happen? You know, if humans, the world keeps on moving, you know, we don't know much. So let's just work with what we know. Let's get something in the bag. Let's get something that works. And then we will advance, you know. And all the time, we're learning.
So if I wanted to phrase it in a different way, so let me say, make a statement or a couple of statements, and you can tell me if I'm thinking correctly. So in the modern world, in the 21st century, if you want to build a piece of software, it could be a website, could be an app for your Android or iPhone or iOS platform. It could be whatever piece of software that you're interested in, anything worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
So these days, when you want to start, you should think of the end user, the person who is going to finally use it, and think about their use case. What is the problem that your piece of software will solve for them and try to take a stab at it in a way, try to solve it in a way that after your discussions with the user, you realize, okay, I think this is a key feature that they want. Let me build it as best as I understand it. Let me not take 6 months. Let me just take a couple of weeks or a couple of days, and I can put together something. Maybe it is a prototype in the beginning. Whatever it is, that I can show it to them, show them what I'm thinking. Hey, does this solve your problem? Let them use it. Let them actually use it. And then if it is not solving their needs, they will give feedback. And then we say, okay, our assumption was incorrect here, here, and here. So let's go back and change it. But because our development cycle is so short, it doesn't hurt much. It doesn't cost much money to go back and do it again.
Yeah. When you got a short development cycle, how badly can you mess up? If every, you know, typically teams are doing it every 2 weeks now. If every 2 weeks you're reviewing what you've got and you're getting feedback from your users, how badly can you go wrong in 2 weeks? You know, even if you completely misunderstand them, you've wasted 2 weeks. You won't make the same mistake twice. Yeah. The key to all of this is small. Learn to think small. It's almost impossible to think too small. Do you ever hear about that app that was big years ago? Yo. It was an iPhone app, and you just put in the numbers of your friends. I took it out of your contact book, and you hit the app. You just hit them on this app, and on their machine, on their screen, it said, yo. And that was all it did. And this was big. The guy who wrote it, he got VC investment. That was all it did. You know? You just think small, small, small. The smaller the thing you can build, the less effort you're going to put into it. The less effort you put into it, the faster you're going to have something. The smaller the thing you show to your user, the faster, therefore, you're going to get feedback. The faster you get feedback, the sooner you will know whether the thing you're building is right or wrong. If it's right, you do some more. You go round the loop again. If it's wrong, you go back and start over. And because it's small, and because you didn't take too long, you've not wasted a lot of time. Small, small, small. You've got to get lots of little tiny small things. Get good at doing small. And this is where, you know, the continuous delivery DevOps movement is all about. It's about optimizing ourselves, our processes, our organizations, our technology to be good at doing lots of small, lots of really tiny stuff and making it efficient to do it so we can get the feedback. And feedback can be a very nebulous word. So let me be very specific here. The best form of feedback is money. The best form of feedback is cold cash. I write books, and I now write books using a platform called LeanPub. And the great thing about LeanPub is you can put a book before it's finished and people can buy it. People can give you money. You know, it's one thing. It's great when people email me and say, I read your book and I really like this chapter, but can you change this? Or I think you should include this. That's great. But, you know, when people give you money, it's good. You know that they are saying, look, this book is worth $7. $7, which I've sweated to get. $7 is a theater ticket. I'm going to give that. Money is feedback. And money is how we, unfortunately, we live in a world where you need money, isn't it? So money has this secondary purpose that allows you to buy beer and things. You know, so people giving you money, they're giving you feedback. They're saying the thing you have given us is worth something. Your thing goes in that direction. Money comes back. So you do lots of little small stuff and people are giving you feedback, maybe money. And it's helping you decide what is the right thing to do and whether what you're doing is the right thing or whether you should do something else. You know, but small, 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 small. The difficult bit is finding really small things which people consider valuable in extreme. Really small things that people give you $1.50 for. You know, Google are really good at this. Have you seen AdWords? You know, some of those clicks on AdWords, people are just paying a few cents. They're advertising. They're just paying a few cents for their ad. Google counts up all those cents and they make billions out of it. They're very efficient at doing lots of small.
Right. So two things come to mind right now. I think what you're describing is exactly right. You want to do something small that's small enough that you can accomplish it in a small amount of time, but it has to be has to have value for the customer so they would be willing to spend money on it or use it for real world purposes. And that's really good. Let me play devil's advocate for a little bit here. So imagine I am a project manager at a large company and I have a large project. Maybe it's a government project. Maybe it's another project that's very large and it affects thousands of people. And I'm hearing Alan talk about building small things. And I'm thinking, well, okay, fine. Maybe I'll do that and I'll make a 1,000 piece of the software and I'll build that. And then make another 1,000 piece and build that. And then I'll build another one. But then, Alan, I've lost track of what I'm building. The big picture, I don't know what I'm doing anymore. I'm just building lots of random little stuff. So how do you respond to that?
Absolutely. We should have some bigger goal. We should have some higher purpose, some what people call missions or big, hairy, audacious goal is another one of them, or massively transformable purpose. We should have some bigger overarching goal, you know, why we're doing this. But the details of what we're doing and how we're doing it, they're all the little small pieces. We know we're trying to drive from New York to San Francisco, but we're driving and we're kind of making it up as we go along because, you know, we don't have the maps. We don't necessarily know the right route. So we're driving down this road and we're looking at the road signs. Okay, right, that looks right. The compass says that's the right direction and we drive off in that direction. And we know generally where we're heading, but what we're not trying to do is take the third left, go 5 miles, take a right. All those little details, we are working out the details as we go along. Two things are happening in parallel. Now, the road network doesn't change very much, but I still find it really hard to follow those instructions that say, go 2 miles, turn left, go 7 miles, turn right. You know, I find it difficult. And in the real world, things are moving. You may think you've got to drive 5 miles down here and turn right. By the time you get there, the right turn isn't there. By the time you get there, you know, somebody else has taken it. And in our world, if somebody else is doing what you were going to do, what's the point? You know, well, you may have a great idea for a taxi company that people call taxis from their mobile phones. But you know what? As soon as you realize Uber's already done that, you're not going to do that. You know, so in our world, the roads are all, the maps are changing. We have imperfect information. There's other people appearing. You know, we could plan out with a map as it is now, but really it's going to fail for one reason or another. We need to have a destination. We need to have something to aim for, yes. But we're going to make it up and do lots of little tiny things as we go along there.
I think so. We need these big milestones or mile markers. We need to know, okay, so we're going to go from New York, we're going to go to New Jersey, and then from there we're going to Pennsylvania and Ohio. And this is, we're going to take this big route. We're not going down to Florida first. We are going through the upper Midwest and we're going to go into California through Nevada. Okay, we understand that. And we're going to take this interstate, generally speaking. So we know this. But going from New York to New Jersey, there may be 5 different ways of doing that. And one of them is blocked because there's been an accident. So now we know that we need to reroute maybe between Pennsylvania and Ohio. There are 5 different ways of doing it, but this one has more congestion because it has maybe, construction going on. So so you plan, and as you are on your path, you realize, wait, you need to reroute. And we know how to do that all the time when we're driving.
Yeah. And one of the problems we have is, when people experience a failure in doing something, the next time they're asked to do something, one of the responses is to try and plan it in more detail. So they add more detail. They spend more time thinking about this. Instead of just saying, well, here's the roads we're going to take, they try and how long am I going to be on that road? What are the chances there's going to be congestion? Is it busy at this time of day? And they put more detail into their plans. But that means there's more things that go wrong. For starters, they spend more time planning. And the more time you spend planning, the later you're going to get to your destination because you just spent time planning. Yeah. And the second is the more detail you put in there, the more potential problems you can put up. You know, the more turns you can't take. the more the chance the maps are out of date. You know, you offer up more of these problems, you're laying down more potential problems. The other problem we have is that it becomes disempowering to the driver. You know, how much fun is it to drive the car when somebody's sitting in the back seat with a map saying, turn left, turn right? You know, we can just about take it from the sat nav on the screen. But you know, when it's somebody sitting in the back seat, you don't want to turn down there. Go back, take the main turn. It's not a fun experience for a driver. It's demotivating. And the same is true if you're a developer and you're trying to work on a project and somebody else is trying to instruct you over everything they do. You know, they're trying to say, do this, do that, and all the rest of it. Although, interestingly, they don't tell you whether to use a for loop or a while loop. You know, there's some level where they cut out. You know, they say this is design, this is project management, and they instruct you to do this, that, and the other. But there's a certain level, you know, naming your variable. They don't give you those details. So where's the boundary? Mm-hmm. And for me, every line of code you cut, every variable you name, whether you use a for loop, a while loop, or, you know, everything is an act of design. You know, and that design goes from the bottom up and it requires thinking about. And the designs are themselves a form of planning. So these ideas that there's some kind of plan, there's some kind of architecture, and then there's the code, and they are three separate things. They can be separated. I don't buy it. When you're writing code, everything you're doing is an act of design, and that permeates all the way up the stack. You know, the decisions you make at a very micro level can have big effects at the higher level. I'll give you an example. Some years ago, I worked in financial systems, and we were connecting to this stock exchange, and they were sending us price information, just saying, there's been a buy, there's been a sell, all the rest of it. And there was two ways. They told you what had been traded and what price had been traded at. And there was two ways to work out what the quantity was, how much was left in the market. They gave you a number, and they also gave you the delta, how much it had changed. So you could either take the last number you had and add or subtract the delta, or you could just take the number they gave you. For reasons I honestly do not understand, I chose to take the delta and apply it to the existing number. Our competitor took the absolute number. One company had both systems, and one company realized that our system and our competitors were giving different numbers. Is a hell of a bug to find. Turned out you usually saw it on a Friday afternoon. And there's a really complicated reason that you normally saw it on an afternoon, particular Friday afternoon. We thought it was something to do with New York coming online because we were here in London and New York came online after lunch. Yeah. Turned out it was because traders went home early.
Oh.
So I'd been writing this code and I did it one way, and another me at another organization did it the other way. And we ended up with this massive bug in the system. Yeah. Tiny, tiny decision. You know, who's to say I was right or wrong? You know, but those decisions had this massive ripple effect, not only on the code, but on the systems, the way we were operating, and on the banks that were using our systems. You know, there's huge problems because me and another guy had chosen to do something different, and the exchange's system didn't quite behave the way it said it should. Everything is about design. You can't decompose this stuff. It comes to a level where you can't decompose it into architecture and programming and planning. It's the same thing.
So if I look at it from a project manager or a product manager's point of view, and that he's thinking or she's thinking that this is exactly why I like to keep control of everything, because I can't give these lowly developers control over my design. I need to control everything. So what I'm hearing from you is you have to devolve control down to the person who's writing the code, and that person is most definitely involved in architectural decisions, and these are part of the design, but yeah. you need to have all those people in the design. You can't have this ivory tower designer or architect sitting there, because I've seen this in certain cases, I've seen it where there is an architect who never writes a piece of code, and all he does is gives, you know, big documents. And then there's maybe another person that will break it down into components. But and then sometimes there would be another layer who would go down and be very specific about classes. And then this other developer who's just supposed to translate into code their typist. Ideas. Yeah, the typist. The typist. They want And I've seen it. And I've seen it at really large corporations, and I'm amazed at it.
Okay, yeah. So you got those people, you feel like saying to them, why did you hire the typists? You don't trust them. Why did you hire them? And, you know, particularly with project managers, you know, if you're so good at understanding code, why don't you write it? Yeah. And, you know, you talk about large organizations. I've seen this too, particularly in large organizations. You don't see it so much in small organizations because they can't afford this much dysfunctionality. Yeah. And these large organizations, it's like they're scared of letting anyone code. They have a fear, a phobia of coding because they've come to believe coding is expensive and disruptive, and they'd like to be done in a faraway place as cheaply as possible. But before they let anyone code, they want to cross every T, dot every I, think of every eventuality. And they get wrapped up in these massive planning cycles, you know, which they may be learning for the first, you know, hour, but, you know, by hour three, they aren't. And by hour six, you know, they're definitely, you know, losing it. And these cycles are gone for days, you know, and I look at these people and it's crazy to me. And I'm reminded of this story. This story is on Wikipedia. So this story, I believe, is true, that when they were filming Marathon Man, I think Dustin Hoffman was the lead actor. You know, it's great method acting. He was much younger at the time. And they also had, I think it was John Gielgud, one of the great Shakespearean actors from England there. And Hoffman goes to Gielgud and he says, Mr. Gielgud, I'm honored to be working with you, Mr. Gielgud. I've admired all your work, your Hamlet, your King Lear. I really want to learn from you. He says, can you tell me, you know, I've studied the method school. How do you know how to act? And Gielgud says, my dear boy, have you tried acting? I look at these organizations with all their planning cycle and their architects and their managers upon managing. I say, have you tried coding? You know, all this planning, you could just spend an hour coding and see what happens, you know. And oh God, going back to the small stuff, I think there's something about large organizations find it incredibly hard to do small stuff. They wrap themselves in knots. And pessimistic me, I sometimes wonder if these large organizations have got a future. You know, clearly Apple and Google do. They're big and they get it. But, you know, you look at some of the legacy banks, airlines, utilities, you think, you guys, your business is becoming digital. And you guys you're still rooted in 1970. We've moved on. You're probably going to be disrupted by somebody who gets it.
Yeah. Yes, it's the state of affairs that we have. And companies, large corporations, people who have been in the industry for a long time or have been making software for a long time, they are sometimes out of touch. And that's the unfortunate reality. But that's an opportunity for newcomers. So
Yeah. And, you know, it takes us right back to where we were half an hour ago. You know, you're saying about that exam I did where they were giving marks for a go-to statement. And the world had moved on, but the people who got to set the marking criteria, they was like 20 years out of date.
Alan, it's been so fun talking to you. Fantastic. And I think we can go on for hours.
Another day.
And perhaps another day. It's been a long time. I mean, this interview has gone on longer than I like. But I think we'd like to have you back to talk about some of your books and some of your achievements and some of your ideas on, I will not call it Agile, I will call it Alan Kelly Method.
yeah, doing good stuff.
Doing good stuff. But before we go, I'd like you to give some advice to Well, first of all, to managers who are looking to hire new developers.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I'd like you to give advice to people who want to be software developers, who are curious, who have just started, maybe they're new.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell them? And also one more thing after that, but let's focus on hiring managers and new developers.
So hiring managers, so two pieces of advice. One, if you're working through a recruitment agent, a recruiter, different places go by different names, the recruitment companies are half of the problem. Most of the recruiters, recruitment agents, they don't understand the industry and they are now keyword driven, the databases, they search for people. If you want to hire people, you've got to put in some effort. And it may be you can find somebody in your organization or you can find one of the good freelancers to help you find good people. The other thing is when it comes to interviewing people, all the best companies I know actually get the interview candidate to come in and cut code, to spend half a day, maybe a week even, with the people they're going to be working with cutting code. If you're hiring somebody who's going to code, if you are hiring a piano player, you'd want to hear them play the piano. If you're hiring a coder, you want to code and you want to see them coding with your people on your code base and you want to get their reaction. And don't be scared that they'll be upset by your code, because I'd rather they were upset by your code in an interview and decide they didn't want to work with you than they sign on the dotted line and the day they start working for you say, oh my God, did I really come to work here? And if you're so ashamed of your code, you don't want to let people see it, then you've got a serious problem, right? So if you're hiring people, get them in. Get them in for an hour or 2 hours at the least and get them to work with one of your guys some code. You're going to have to edit this. It's just told me Java wants to update. Skip. Okay. So advice to people who people who want to get into coding or people who want to get hired as a coder?
People who want to establish themselves as successful developers. They're just starting out.
Yeah. So successful developers. So if you're starting out, get out and meet people. You know, I learned to program. I was like 12. I was in my room and I had a book and I worked through the book. You know, I just learned that way. And if you're 12, that's probably what you do. But these days, you know, wherever you are, there are meetups, there are get-togethers, there are conferences. You can get out there. You can expose yourselves to people. Just learn to take in diverse sources, listen to people. Talk to people. I know stereotypically developers don't like talking to people. I'm not sure I believe that stereotype, but you know, get out, meet people, learn new things. I have a friend, Russell. He claims the best thing a programmer can do is learn one new language every year. And I think when I was getting started, you know, I said before, I originally taught myself BASIC and I taught myself assembly and I taught myself Pascal. After Pascal came forth and my first few years, I was learning a language a year. So don't just learn a little bit of JavaScript and stick there for 5 years. You know, learn a bit of JavaScript, try a bit of real Java, try a bit of something else. You know, when you're starting out, there's never been a better time to try different ideas. So be open to things. Go and expose yourselves to new ideas.
And I was going to ask you about something else, but I think we're going to wrap up now. And maybe we'll get a chance to talk to you about this later. So let me give you a hint what I was going to ask you. Because I think these days we have this opportunity for a new developer who is maybe 16 or maybe 36 or whatever his background is or he or she is thinking, you know, I really don't want to get a job in a corporation and be a stooge. Maybe I can do my own thing, build a product and make money. And there's an idea there. But maybe you want to talk a little bit about this before we close, and then we can talk about more about this later.
Yeah. So, you know, I did this myself. You know, as I said, as a teenager, I managed to write programs and I sold them to magazines and the BBC. I guess these days you write an app yourself, you put it on the App Store, don't you? You put it out there, and you know, having something you want, an idea of your own, is great because, you know, just coding for the sake of coding ain't a lot of fun. So think of something, push it out there. Remember that for yourself, this is largely about learning. We can all dream about writing an app, putting it on the App Store and the world loving it and becoming a millionaire. That's unlikely. It could happen. You know, it's unlikely. But yes, take yourself, experience that stuff, build something which you will find useful that you think maybe other people will find useful. And, you know, particularly when you're young, you know, here I am, a middle-aged guy with kids and a mortgage. I can't take those kind of risks anymore. But, you know, if you're still at school, you can do so many things. You know, you haven't got so much to lose, frankly. You can take the time and you can do it. You know, you can miss the odd cinema night, you know, sit there and play with stuff and see if people like it, show it to other people. And I also remember when I was a teenager, I had a buddy, a guy called David, and sometimes we'd do stuff together, you know, and we wrote some programs together and we sold some programs together. You know, if there's somebody else who has interests like yours, buddy up and do it.
Yes, I think that's great advice. There are lots of opportunities for new developers because there are lots of problems in the world that have not been solved. And maybe they're too small for big companies to solve, but maybe just big enough for you and you can make a decent amount of money and you can get the exposure and you can establish yourself as a professional, serious, hardcore software developer without going through the traditional route. It's possible.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people these days who talk about programmers having a portfolio, you know, and programmers presenting the portfolio at an interview, you know, so you check your code into GitHub and your resume says, here's my code on GitHub. And people can look at your code and say, hey, this guy does really write stuff. This guy's stuff works. You know, you might not contribute to open source yet, but they can see you've actually got some stuff. You know, show them you're real.
That's really good advice. GitHub is your friend, people.
Well, I'm a Bitbucket fan myself, but you know, either one's good.
Yeah, Bitbucket is awesome too. It just doesn't have the social aspects. So if you want to show off, you want to be on GitHub.
You're right there, awesome.
All right, Alan. So how can people get in touch with you if they want to learn more about your work, your books? You do so much stuff. Tell us a little bit about how to get in touch with you.
My web address is alankelly.net, right? So you can just go to that and you can find things out. If you don't remember that, just Google Alan Kelly. The only thing is there's two L's in Alan. I've written a whole bunch of books. If you go to Lean Pub, I've got several books there. One of them, my latest book, Continuous Digital, which is about kind of the antidote to projects. Is unfinished. You can read a book in progress. I've got books on my approach to Agile. You can buy those books. They're quite cheap. So Lean Pub, my website. On Twitter, I'm just alankelly.net. So it's just my web address without www and all the dots. And I'm more than happy to get email and tweets. If you've got a question, just tweet it, email it over. If you email me a good question, I might ask you if I can answer it in a blog. I love doing that. People send me a question sometimes and I'll answer it in a blog and I'll share it with the world.
That's really good. I think this is also a good exercise in how to brand yourself, how to present yourself. So you're Alan Kellynet. If I Googled you and if I find you in any context, is usually going to be, and there is probably no other Alan Kellynet in the world.
Oh, no. There's no other Alan Kellynet because I own the domain, but Alan Kelly is actually a very common name.
It is a very common name, but yeah. In the context of software development, you have cornered the market on Alan Kelly.
you will tell which Alan Kelly is the right one.
Yes. So that's awesome. And all of those links and the links for his books and everything that we can find on Alan and his contact information is all going to be on the show notes for this podcast episode. If you want to go there, go to mentoringdevelopers.com/episode60 and you'll have everything there. We'll have a transcript. It's going to be a lot of fun. So thank you again for joining us. If you want to email us, send us an email at us@mentoringdevelopers.com. We had a lot of fun, Alan. I'll see you later.
Thank you very much. See you around.
Bye.
Bye.
Hi, folks. Arslan here again. Do you ever wonder if you're getting paid what you're worth? Now, salary is a taboo subject in the US and North America and the world in general. We don't really know if we are getting paid enough for the type of work that we're doing, where we live, and so on. Nobody talks about it. So if you're curious about it and you want to get an insight into how much you might get paid and what's the sort of general salary trend in the world and in the US in particular, you're curious about that, go ahead and sign up for my mailing list where I'm going to send you emails and essentially anecdotal reports and some really firsthand reports on how much you can expect to get paid. I'm working on that and I'd like you to be a part of it. So go ahead and go to mentoringdevelopers.com/list. mentoringdevelopers.com/list. I'll see you there.
For show notes and transcripts, visit us at mentoringdevelopers.com.